a lot of actual diversity in the world when it comes to cultural and musical diversity has to do with traditions being held by somebody. Yeah. And where we in the West have uprooted ourselves, rerooting ourselves and refinding those old traditions where we can.
You are listening to the Music and Peacebuilding Podcast, a professional development network at musicpeacebuilding.com. Exploring intersections of peacebuilding, sacredness, community creativity, and imagination through research and story. In this podcast, we will explore the beautiful, creative, and challenging work of Dan Shivock's Eco-Literate Music Pedagogy. Dan Shivock teaches at Penn State Altoona and serves on the steering committee for the Mayday Group, and is chair of NAFME's Creativity Special Research Interest Group. He is the author of Eco-Literate Music Pedagogy. As you listen, I hope you notice what I love most about his scholarship and being: the playfulness of his creativity and voice, and the degree to which he integrates and synthesizes diverse knowings.
So I want to talk, I want to start in that in your book you talk about interdisciplinary inquiry and intersectionality. And I thought maybe we could start talking about your childhood, because I know you have some cool stories about childhood with soil, and I was wondering about your intersectional love for soil, Catholic spirituality, and music, and how those kind of emerged for you.
Well, certainly my family is very devout Catholics. Mm-hmm. I never remember a time when I wasn't going to church, you know, as a child. So singing was church singing. So music was making music in church. Additionally, my father also, growing up in small towns, he, like everybody else, had at least a garden, right? Mm-hmm. A garden for food in the back and flowers around the Mary statue in the front. And we took care of those every year. So, you know, putting your hands in soil mm-hmm. was just something that was done. It was part of just being, right? And all mm-hmm. these things are connected as a child. When you think about, you know, every aspect of your life, God, the creator, right? Mm-hmm. The creator, the creation. Those things are just, you're not at a point where you can think of them as separate. You know, you can't separate, oh, this is gardening, and this is religion, and this is music, right? Those things are all connected, you know? They all kind of like blend together. So that affects my work, right? Because then if I can keep a hold of that childlike realization of how everything is one, right? This connectedness of everything. Mm-hmm. Then whenever I approach my career as a music teacher, right, it never made sense to be that, you know, there's this thing in aesthetic writers where just about the music, right? The music itself. Mm-hmm. Or even earlier in that, people who write about Bach write about absolute music, right? Like music that doesn't talk about anything else is somehow better, right? It's deserves to be put on a higher rung than other music, as if Bach didn't play in Lutheran churches his mm-hmm. whole career, right? Or so if you go into life, you know, thinking, well, how am I going to separate that? What you're really doing is taking a scientific mind to everyday experience, right? But everyday experience, you don't dissect, here's the lung, here's the heart, here's music, here's religion, here's, you know, every other aspect, right? But they kind of, you know, are together. They're linked mm-hmm. naturally. So we separate them when we do philosophy or scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. But they're not naturally so. They're naturally bound, what's called a ecology, right? And ecology is always referenced to the more than human world too, right? Non-human animals and places, right? Places matter a lot. Mm-hmm. And soundscapes, since we listen to make sense of the world, right? We use our ears to make sense of the world.
And I notice how your child Penny is kind of a major character in your philosophy, because Penny is the child's eyes who kind of allows you to re-see and reimagine the world around you. Is it?
Yeah, so fair? This has been a major benefit to me. So whenever I was doing my dissertation, Penny was an infant sitting on my lap while I'm typing away on the on the laptop. He's the laptop, the top of the lap, and then the laptop's below that. And yeah, but so that's when I realized, while doing my dissertation, or just thereafter, that I really wanted to connect ecological issues to my work as a music teacher, music education scholar, philosopher, that all these things should be brought back together, because that's how a child experiences them. Now he's in kindergarten, so I've had 5 years of re-experiencing all of these things that we can so easily forget as adults.
Yeah.
Dan spoke of the difference between consciousness and literacy. Literacy is our ability to focus on discrete concepts and our move to abstraction that allows us to think beyond our immediate experience, a process that allows us to become critically conscious.
In your article, My Story of Rurality, Whiteness, Musicking, and Teaching, you talk about going from being a successful student teacher to one who is struggling to connect with my students. And I sense in this story is the genesis of this idea about being locally rooted in a place. Can you talk about what that means in that context?
Yeah, so, right, yeah. So I was the student teacher of the year, right? I won the award at Clarion in 1997 and then went after the summer to moved from central PA to Maryland, to a suburban outside of Baltimore, suburban Maryland, and started teaching, and very quickly realized that, you know, there just wasn't, I wasn't making connections. Mm-hmm. So part of this is definitely your first year of teaching, and what I, you know, over the years, informally mentoring teachers, right, early teachers, you know, there's a lot of reasons why you might fail as a teacher, and just because you fail in your first couple of years doesn't mean that you're going to fail as a teacher permanently. Sometimes it's about finding the right place. In Maryland, I had very few social connections, meaningful social connections. So I didn't have friends that moved down with me. I didn't have many family members that lived close to where I was teaching. And culturally, there's a lot different between suburbanites and rural people as well. So, I mean, that's maybe a generalizable, but definitely specific to central PA, rural people, and suburban East Coast, right? There's a lot of differences there. So that was a lot of things to figure out at once as a teacher. So how do I teach ethically when I'm trying to get my feet out from under me, right? When I'm trying to... you know, I'm driving past all these unfamiliar places.
In Shivak's notion of rootedness, he speaks about the problems of the belief in the universality of a teacher's license. Does having a teacher's license make me a good teacher in any context? Is there a sense of rootedness, knowing and investing into my community, that is at the heart of teaching? Is the idea of a go-anywhere teacher license a kind of myth that hides the importance of investing in the local community?
So a lot of your philosophy rests on this term musicking and rests on the idea of praxial philosophy. So maybe for our listeners who aren't as... who haven't encountered these terms as much, can you tell us about how these terms live within your work?
Yes. Yeah, so music, for me, is kind of a misnomer, right? When we say music, the word is a noun, right? Just like table is. But I can pick up a table. If I take a table and I shoot it in a rocket and it lands on Alpha Centauri, right? it's still a table on theory, unless there's something there, right? If it's really hot or something, right? But it's still a table as long as it doesn't get destroyed. Music, though, is not doesn't function as a noun in the same way. If I were to take music and shoot it into Alpha Centauri, it would be a collection of sounds in some way, but it wouldn't be music. So, but music king, when we talk about music king as a verb, so to music, that's really what people do. They music, and they music for many, many different purposes, right? So all of a sudden, we go from it being a noun, where it becomes the end of a sentence, John makes music, to John musics, right? And that open space there after the verb, music's gender identity, John musics racial conscientization, right? John musics for justice, right? John musics
a love of nature,
right? A love of nature. John musics political satire, right? It doesn't, right? It's not done for many reasons, right? John musics for fame, right? But all of a sudden, right, then we have a much more robust sentence, right? A much robust understanding of what's happening in the experience of music whenever we put it right in the middle of a sentence, because then we're forced to then go on with that sentence.
I love that idea.
Because makes isn't a particularly robust verb, right? So just from a language, right? You know, if you, your high school English teacher would tell you, you need a better verb than that, right? But music itself as a verb then becomes a really good verb.
Inspired by Dan's work, I have been captivated by the work of a preeminent acoustic ecologist, Gordon Hempton. After listening to an On Being interview he did with Krista Tippett, I reached out to Mr. Hempton about this episode. Gordon Hempton has musicked beautiful, rich soundscapes across the world. With his permission and in the spirit of Dan Shivak's work, we listened to his recent project to music the sounds of the last remaining places of silence on the earth. 1 square inch of silence. Dan Shivak speaks to the importance of the Good Samaritan story in his own Catholic heritage as a story that expands the boundaries of in-groups and out-groups. While many members of the in-group walked by a victimized traveler, it is finally a Samaritan, a member of the out-group who has compassion and cares for the injured. In a similar way, Shivak challenges us to find stories that imagine an interwoven bond between human and ecosphere. Can we be cared for by the raven as a First Nation North American folktale imagines? Or to imagine an ecological brotherhood as St. Francis did?
And talk to something I think it's really important about your book. At one point you talk about the difference between ecology and then the separation of the use of the word environment. You know, there's self and the other. Can you talk about why you chose the word ecology?
Right, yeah, I choose the word ecology, I mean, for a number of reasons, right? First, the eco part, right? Ecology refers, it's the Greek word for home, which is why it's connected to economics. It's supposed to be how the household survives, right? But when we talk about home, we're talking about familial relationships, right? Which takes me, my mind anyway, to the Franciscan tradition, right? Of St. Francis going around 800 years ago, calling the sun his brother and the moon his sister, right? Calling animals, you know, calling this, right? This wolf here is my brother. you know, not necessarily having this larger concept of wolves, mm-hmm. right, or suns, right? He's talking about this specific sun, this specific moon, yeah, this specific wolf, you know, that he's has a family relationship with, right? So if we look at ecology and that family relationship, and we know that the word, unless if it's being misused, refers to not just humans, but also non-human actors, right? Non-human agents and places as well.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to
environment already presupposes a distinction. Mm. So when I say environment, I'm talking about here I am in my environment. Thinking about it as environment draws us into this modern, controlled, or at least false belief in control. Because as we know, our use of air conditioning and stuff is coming back, right? in the form of hurricanes and droughts and flooding, right?
And this is how we get to this other word, which is natural resources, conceiving of everything as a resource to be used and consumed.
Right, yeah. So once you have an environment, then it's a resource to be used, right? And you may, so if you conceive as a conceive of your park as a resource, right? Your local park, you know. This year, it may benefit your community to use it for playground equipment, right? Mm. And to maybe put in some bat boxes. But next year, maybe it benefits your community more in a down economy to sell off the trees and log them, right? But then 7 generations down the line, to use another indigenous concept, right? 7 generations down the line, who really benefits from having this scorched area with no trees? Mm-hmm. Right? So the environment, our modern conceptions of resources, right? They're very short-termed, right? Sometimes they're quarterly when they're economic, right? But we really should be thinking 7 generations in the future or doing even better, right? We have, you know, we're able to conceive even broader, right? We can conceive what does our society look like if we're going to live another 200,000 years as Homo sapiens, mm-hmm. right? Now, that would be really taking science to heart, knowing that Homo sapiens, 200,000 years, right? Some Homo erectus also had music, right? They had, if I remember right, they found, like in Romania or Turkey, they found like a flute, right? So then we're pushing even further back, right? More than 200,000 years where humans mm-hmm. of some form had music, right? So what does our music, what does our society, what does our lifestyle, what does our culture look like to make it another 500,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think back to my some research I did recently with some members of the culture within Somaliland, just north of Somalia. And one of the things that blew my mind the most was we asked this gentleman about his family. And he took out his hands and he started counting back 14 generations. And he knew the connection, that idea of generational history, I think, is so important to being able to imagine maybe our impact.
Yeah, we have to recover our sense of history, right? We have such mm-hmm. a minimal sense of history. You put it into a book and accept it, right? And the people that they decided to write about 300 years ago, right? Those are the important people from 300 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, but obviously, this gentleman could talk about his family for an extended period of time, and he remembered names. Maybe he remembered an action or two from the person. They stay alive mm-hmm. in that community in a way. We lose a lot of memory when we start writing things, right? Mm-hmm. Plato noticed that, right, in one of his dialogues that when people start writing, they don't remember. They don't remember enough of the Iliad to be able to say the whole thing, right? And people sang the Iliad, right? The Iliad was a sung thing until it became written, and then people had to refer to the written text to remember it. They just didn't remember it, you know. So writing things down, in some way, we lose some things. But we can, I think, maybe this is a little bit too optimistic, but I think that we can learn from both styles of being, right? Mm-hmm. You know, what I'm calling gardening and wilderness, or what I'm calling consciousness and literacy, right? Those parallel ideas, you know, the things we touch, right, with history, and the things that we have to just conceptualize.
Dan Shivak writes of the contributions of Sadis Coleman as having particular importance in rebalancing the male-dominated, Eurocentric history of music education. Sadis Coleman was a pioneering female pedagogue, philosopher, who for Shivak exemplifies a pedagogical move towards spirituality, creativity, and a choice to become rooted in the wonder of ecological context.
Why does she inform a philosophy that's eco-literate? Like, what's some concrete examples of
that? Yeah. So I talked all around that. But yeah, she would regularly take her students outside, right? Famously, she took them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where they would look at historic examples of instruments around the world, and they would draw them, right? Bring them back and construct those instruments. Right, so she's a predecessor to like world music pedagogy or whatever that's being called today, right? But in addition, she took them outside into nature, where she directed them to listen to what we today call soundscapes, mm-hmm. right? So they listen to the music of the birds, right? And she talks about how she observed robins, and she observed a mother robin teaching her children the songs, right? And how the children, robins, had a less developed song first off, and she watched them over time, right? So this is a very observational thing, and that's something that more recent zoomusicological research has found, that a lot of birds teach their songs to their young, right? Not all of them, you know, mm-hmm. but it's not all instinct. They also educate, right? So again, this makes you think, well, she's observing what's obviously right there. That's scientifically proven fact now, 80 years later or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But you could just, if you were slowing down and looking, you know, you see the truth that animals have a lot of similarities to us, right? A lot of the things that we would like to say, this is human, this is animal. Well, education isn't one of them. Right? Music isn't one of them. Whales sing songs and share them, and they become popular for a couple years and then fade away, and other songs become popular. So having popular melodies that last for a bit of time and then disappear, right, isn't a human-only phenomenon. So less and less, mm-hmm. right? And so that spiritually, and it wouldn't, I can't say it would have drawn Sadis Coleman this way, right? But spiritually, that draws me towards what Thomas Berry wrote. He drew on Chardin, right? Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and who drew on Bergson, right? this idea of this evolutionary spirit, right? Towards greater consciousness, greater complexity, right? So if you look at that, what's physically happening biologically to the universe. Spiritually, it's occurring also, right? Mm-hmm. Towards some type of omega point. Listen, waiting, connecting, linking, joining, thinking, integrating, listen, waiting. Nature thrums, hums, pulsating, beaks as drums, cicada, trumpets, jumping, playing, listen, waiting. Disciplines descend through thought, children bringing what they brought. Squirrels, their heavy raucous dancing, resonant and playful prancing, listen waiting, writing, reading, science speeding, slowly dawdling, singing, modeling, novel ways of understanding, nature's melodies and phrases, connecting, linking, joining, thinking, integrating, listen waiting.
In Dan Shivak's recent article, A Practice of Silence, he called music educators into a meditative sense of listening and noticing. He writes, "Through a meditative practice, I can relive successes, be inspired with new ideas, and allow the musics of the soundscape, birds, insects, and winds, to dissolve my disquiet and focus my pedagogy on that which, to me, matters most."
Birdsong. Birdsong symphonizes this morning. For whose benefit? Crows call and sparrows chip. For whose benefit? And spontaneously, freely, children dance and sing. For whose benefit?
Dan problematizes the way we view the scientific notion of evolution. Our framing of this concept paints a view of a violent world where only the strong survive. If we are to live into a spiritual sense of mutuality, the notion of mutual aid may deepen our ecological frames and relationships.
Because evolution, you know, requires a lot of things like, what's the old barbaric term, survival of the fittest, right? You know, I don't really see that happening spiritually, not in a good way anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe Kropotkin's old book on evolution, Mutual Aid, is a better model, especially with what we know with like Lynn Margulis's research, you know, looking at the symbiotic elements of evolution, right? It's not all survival of the fittest, right? Or, you know, Darwin never used that term, actually. That actually came out of Herbert Spencer, right? It was a white supremacist and stuff, right? For a reason, he wanted to layer this down onto social systems in a specific way that empowered certain people and disempowered others. Hopefully we can watch that and avoid that and take what's true while discarding what's unacceptable.
Or in many ways violent.
Violent,
from a peace-building lens. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah, so let's move into spirituality. This is how you close your book, and I have two quotes I wanted to read to you, your response to them. But you write, participating in industrial society, we built, sold, bought, spoiled, and threw away our way into ecological crisis. This is the having mode. We have become disconnected from one another, and we further exacerbate the having mode. Degrading ourselves, we become human havings rather than human beings. It should be no surprise human havings degrade the environment. How do you sense this as a spiritual crisis in your work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I took this idea of human havings versus human beings from Eric Fromm, and I don't know if he would call it spiritual at all. In fact, he would probably stick away from that. And he would probably call it psychological, right? But I consider it spiritual not just as well, but because I consider the psychological thing spiritual. But it is, it's a spiritual crisis, right? So when you have, when you adopt the having mode, right, your existence is defined by what you have. So I have this accomplishment. I have, right, there's ways spirituality could be this way too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you think right. In my own tradition, the Catholic tradition, right, you could have a certain set of letters after your name, like SJ for Jesuits, right, or OSB for Benedictines, right? You can have a papal appointment. You can have, right?
You can
there's
have
a number,
mats
of, right? They put some having things on top of that, mm-hmm. right? But that's not positive necessarily for spirituality. Spirituality degrades by having, and not only does spirituality, but the environment, and it can't but be connected. Our spiritual well-being and our connections to the environment. There's a lot destroying the environment. Almost all of it that I found is connected to having.
Mm.
Right? We have a certain speed of travel that we didn't have 100 years ago, right? Mm. And therefore we have a climate crisis. We have things wrapped perfectly cleanly in plastics, and therefore we have the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, right? So readjusting, right? Human beings, our essence, right, is to be.
Mm.
You know, this is, you know, everybody's been answering this, right? Since Socrates through Plato, Aristotle, different answers, right? Descartes, right? Think, therefore I am, right? Which focuses on thinking, right? About 1,000 years before that, St. Augustine wrote, I make mistakes, therefore I am, right? Putting emphasis on making mistakes. When I see the emphasis of modern society of Cartesian thought, but not of Augustinian thought, I wonder, well, how would we be different if everywhere we value thinking, we valued mistakes?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that would be very interesting. But then again, it's about being. It's just about being.
I spoke with Dan Shivak about the tension between conservatism and liberation. Shivak writes, in conversation, I convert to sense what to conserve. I want to conserve musical traditions that cannot and should not be ossified into universities. I want to conserve places and musics the industry doesn't. I want to leave a viable, diverse, healthy planet for my child. We talked about the practice of conserving musical traditions without fossilizing them into components of music curricula. And we talked about the danger of progressive liberation and our Western history of quote-unquote liberating indigenous peoples through economic development in a way that often destroys places, cultures, and peoples. How do we sow deep roots, conserving our place and allowing the winds of change to honor the beauty of evolving diversity?
And I think isn't that a big ethical dilemma about who does the liberating or who does the conserving? That's the power of Freire, who you cite, and that practice for you, which becomes literacy, is that practice of critical consciousness.
Yeah, critical consciousness. So as we look at the roots, right, and we go to the roots and we keep looking and we're so this is something also that, you know, maybe make me the same as other Freireans, maybe it makes me a little different, right, that I'm not satisfied with the roots I find. You know, I find the roots in capitalism and racism and sexism, right? But, you know, as we keep looking at the roots, there's other roots to the problem, right? And some of the roots are good, right, to sustain the tree as well. You know, to sustain a diversity of ways of being in the world. diversity of definitions of music and who gets counted as a musician, a diversity of stories about music, and the ways of living that are embedded in those stories, right? Those culture, right? Culture is back to that idea of cult and local, seasonal festivals, the way to live in a place as the seasons change, right? We need more of these diverse ways of being as we face growing ecological catastrophes, right? Because we need to conceive how to live well. Sounding wild, hearing wild. All that thrives within the mind. All that loves, lives, and binds. All that moves, all that waits. All that's cruel and kind. Comes from old and ancient oak. Comes when Gabriel's horn first spoke. Comes asleep when dreamers woke. Wakening to truth non-remote. Windy, chilling wilderness. Charming, sunny wilderness. Thunder crashing wilderness. Dying stags of wilderness. Loving wild, living wild. Sounding wild, hearing wild.
I think what I have translated out of your work into peace building is when I've put your work beside theories about humanization and dehumanization, I take those and I see that in many ways we constantly are trying to dehumanize ourselves by saying, we're not an animal. I don't have an existential end. I can buy life insurance. I can preserve myself. And in many ways, maybe the job of a music educator is to rehumanize ourselves and bring us into a deeper sense of recognition that we are animals and that we have a relation, an ecological relationship to this connected world in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. We are. So, I mean, there's a reason, like, you know, Greenpeace is called Greenpeace, right? You know, it was a peace movement that those activists grew out of, right? And they started protesting nuclear testing, right, on an island outside of Alaska, right? And nuclear testing is a challenge to both peace and to ecology, right? They've always been connected concepts, peace and ecology. They've never only existed separately.
Special thanks to Dr. Dan Shivak. His book, titled Ecoliterate Music Pedagogy, is available from Routledge Press. Thanks are also extended to Gordon Hempton for the use of his recorded soundscapes and public domain audio from the U.S. National Park Service. Links will be provided on our website. May we all sow deep roots that curl and hold with the diversity of our mutual being. Musicking into ecological being, sounding radiant sunrise or symphonies of inner silence. This is the Music and Peacebuilding Podcast, hosted by Kevin Shorner Johnson. At Elizabethtown College, we host a Master of Music Education with an emphasis in peacebuilding. Thinking deeply, we reclaim space for connection and care. Join us at musicpeacebuilding.com.